Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
Criminal justice advocates say they hope to build on victories in recent weeks, like the legalization of adult recreational use of marijuana, to gain more reforms for members of black and brown communities who are incarcerated at higher rates than white New Yorkers. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt explains.
Advocates and progressive-leaning Democratic lawmakers want to add to the recent wins of legal cannabis and a law to limit solitary confinement in state prisons. They hope that in the remaining weeks of the legislative session, they can also see passage of measures that reform the state's parole system. One of the bills, known as Elder Parole, would require the state's parole board to take into account the health of a prisoner aged 55 or older who has already served a significant amount of their sentence. Many of the 10,000 or so inmates in this category suffer from chronic diseases, and some have died in the COVID-19 pandemic. Nuwana Tucker is with the group Release Aging People in Prison, known as RAP. Her husband has been incarcerated for 33 years. She says at age 55, he deserves a chance to be home with his family.
My husband has two children of his own, two grandchildren he has never met.
Tucker and others say the state's criminal justice system needs to offer more than just punishment and should also offer a chance of redemption for those who have served their time for their crimes.
When the parole board in the state of New York does not grant the paroles that so many deserve and you allow them to die in prison, you have now become a murderer yourself. This has to stop.
Assemblymember Carmen De La Rosa sponsors the bill. She says she represents a community adversely impacted by the federal war on drugs and the state's former harsh Rockefeller drug laws. She says many of the men that she grew up with are now in prison because of those laws.
We know that our communities, black and brown communities, are disproportionately sentenced to long sentences without even the possibility of parole. And we know that when they get before the parole board, they are not judged based on any transformation or any system of restoration. They're judged basically on one point in time that they can never change. This has to change because that is at the root core of the inequities that exist in the parole board.
Another bill would require parole board members to take into consideration other factors besides the original crime, including how a person might have changed for the better while in prison. Senator Brad Hoylman, who sponsors the elder parole bill in his house, says the measures do not yet have enough support for passage. He urged advocates to talk to other lawmakers who are still on the fence in the final weeks before the legislature adjourns for the summer.
We're standing on your shoulders to get these bills passed, and I'm so focused on doing that before the end of June.
The lawmakers and advocates are also calling on Governor Andrew Cuomo to change the makeup of the state's parole board. Cuomo appoints the 19 parole board members, and there are currently 3 vacancies. The advocates want the governor to fill those vacancies with commissioners who come from communities adversely affected by high rates of imprisonment and consider appointing social workers, nurses, and those who work in services that help inmates re-enter society. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan?
I thought it was quite telling and revealing in your conversation this week on the Capitol connection with Albany County District Attorney David Soares, where you dealt with police reform and his own personal story of being pulled over, driving while black, and then how to have the talk with his kids.
Yeah, you know, as I have been saying, I have a grandchild who is African-American by birth, and his father has to be aware that he doesn't want to shatter a young person's ego, a beautiful child. And on the other hand, you want to help that child stay safe. And we have seen the manifestation of that as black drivers stop, put their hands out the window to make sure that there can be no excuse. I thought he was, quote, reaching for a gun. Or so they go and they do what they're supposed to do. But it is terrible that white parents don't have to have the same conversation with their kids that black parents do. That, let's face it, there will be people who tell their children that they have to be very polite to policemen, whether they're black or they're white. But there is no question that the onus on people of color in this country is horrible, because we know that too many policemen think driving while black is a crime.
Now, let's go a little further with your conversation with the District Attorney David Soares for a moment. You know, you made a good point in saying that the DA has to have a relationship with the police to conduct his investigations. So as we watch these reform plans come in from across the state, you know, he has to balance that with how that relationship works with police officers and leaders of the police departments.
Hey, you know, we're going to judge our district attorneys, and I'm a great fan of David Soares. I think he's terrific. But we're going to judge our district attorneys by whether they get convictions. And they can't get convictions, and they can't do their jobs if the police are not with them. That has always been one of the biggest problems. So there are sort of walk-arounds, as they might say, in Australia. Let me give you an example. You know, if a policeman has to testify, that testimony will be crucial to whether a district attorney can win a case. So what they're doing now is they're trying to find places where the local DA doesn't have to be involved in that, and you give it to, for example, the state attorney general, Letitia James, and her office, or you give it to a special prosecutor, because those are the ways in which local district attorneys will not be subjected to either harassment or difficulties with the local police. Now, Soares has made it quite clear his relationship with the police is very good. However, one would just understand that it is natural for organizations to protect themselves, and police have always had a way of doing that. I think things are turning around. I always quote my little town of Great Barrington, where the police and the smiles on their faces and how they talk to people has improved about 1,000%. So assuming that that kind of thing continues and that police departments are now getting the word, it will be a very different situation. And hopefully people like the district attorney, David Soares, who I so admire, will be able to get along with his police counterparts and to create a team approach to the conviction of rather serious criminals sometimes.
He made the point as well, Alan, that, you know, if you're looking at police reform from community to community, there are going to be pockets where things are done professionally and things are done in ways that we see splashed all over the news headlines. But he also said that one of the only ways to really do this would be federally, in a federal statute.
Well, if that's done, and it's unlikely that's going to be done in this particular Congress and the Senate, which is 50-50 plus one vote. Because there will be people who just don't want to take on their police departments. It takes tremendous courage to be able to do that. I suspect we're going to see some reforms, all right, but I doubt we're going to see a bill from the federal government that does it, unless, of course, some of the people who would be not likely to vote for such reform or such legislation will be so scared of the population that they have to satisfy that they will do the right thing. Not always possible.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. The Board of Directors at the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, or NYSERDA, has appointed its acting CEO to the role on a permanent basis. Doreen Harris, who has spent more than a decade with NYSERDA, has been leading the agency since June 2020, following the departure of Alicia Barton. Harris is also co-chair of the New York State Climate Action Council, tasked with meeting the goals of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Harris spoke with the Legislative Gazette's Jim Lavoulis.
Yes, it was a real honor and a privilege to be appointed president and CEO of NYSERDA. You know, I firmly believe that no challenge poses a greater threat to our future than climate change, and no institution is better poised to meet that challenge head on than NYSERDA. And as you mentioned, I am a veteran of NYSERDA. I am now the first president of NYSERDA, in fact, who has previously held staff roles across the authority. And certainly during that time, and now specifically in the past 10 months or so as acting president and CEO, I have come to know and directly experience the true value and globally significant impact that NYSERDA has had and will have into the future.
And with you having that staff experience, how do you think that will add to your leadership abilities?
Well, certainly I have direct experience with many, many aspects of NYSERDA's work, but now under the framework of Governor Cuomo's Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, we are placing New York on a path to economy-wide carbon neutrality, and we at NYSERDA are the state's primary clean energy agency. So we are really key to implementing our state's ambitious agenda. So it's exciting to assume this role at this time. You know, we must do everything we can to not only drive climate progress, but also progress that works for all New Yorkers.
And to that point, you are also co-chair of the New York State Climate Action Council, which is tasked with setting up the plan to meet New York's greenhouse gas reduction goals under the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, as you mentioned. Now, that includes an 85% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2050. How specifically will NYSERDA be a part of that plan?
Yes, the coming years will certainly be looked back on as a momentous time for our clean energy transition and climate leadership. So in the coming years, it is true, there are major planning and scoping efforts that will play out before the Climate Action Council, which I co-chair with DEC Commissioner Basil Sagos. Ultimately, we've made tremendous progress this year and now are heading toward the process of developing a scoping plan that will lay out exactly that path to carbon neutrality. I think what we can expect to see generally, though, is billions of dollars of investments committed, an unprecedented scale-up in construction of clean energy infrastructure, and also the need to really develop a cleaner and more affordable and more resilient energy system, along with the technological innovations needed to drive this change. So we're at a very important point, very momentous for the state as to not only the achievement of our goals, but the benefits that will come with it.
And what is the status or the timeline of that scoping plan to meet the ACT's goals?
So the Climate Act actually became effective on January 1st, 2020. We've been hard at work to ensure its success, certainly over the past year, even despite the challenges imposed by the COVID crisis. So right now, we have formed a 22-member Climate Action Council. We have active development and execution of 7 sector-specific advisory panels. And those groups are meeting regularly to develop recommendations that will be proposed very shortly to the Climate Action Council. And then that will integrate within a scoping plan, which is due on January 1st, 2022.
And I wanted to chat with you some more about your experience, specifically with offshore wind. There's been a lot of talk about the Capital Region becoming a hub for wind energy development. There are plans for construction of wind towers at the Port of Albany, and then obviously General Electric maintains a large presence in the region, and they're a player in the wind industry. Now, you've worked on New York's offshore wind efforts. What's your sense of the Capital Region becoming such a hub?
Yes, I've worked in the offshore wind space basically since its beginning here in New York State, and I couldn't think of a better opportunity for us in the Capital Region to benefit from a major clean energy investment. You know, New York has done more on clean energy in recent years than any other state, and the past year is no different. Just this January, there was an incredible announcement with respect to renewable energy procurements by Governor Cuomo, including over 4,000 megawatts of land-based and offshore wind procurements, but importantly for the Capital Region, associated massive port and manufacturing investments. And NYSERDA is integrated within all of this. This is a high water mark, certainly for any state, but ultimately the fact that we're doing it with a real emphasis on infrastructure, workers, and jobs, you know, tying these efforts directly to the clean energy economy is quite notable for a state and for the Capital Region as well.
And then when it comes to utilizing renewable energy sources such as wind and solar, transmission remains an issue, right? I mean, getting the power that's produced to where it is needed. There's either the need to build new lines or update existing ones. How is NYSERDA and New York as a whole approaching that issue?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Transmission is a necessary precursor for the delivery of any energy, but in our case, clean energy, to our load centers. And we as a state are making related investments in transmission infrastructure with multiple projects moving forward as we speak. You know, we at NYSERDA, of course, are facilitating the clean energy. Transmission is related and is really a product of a broader state ecosystem, including other agencies, the utilities, and beyond.
Doreen Harris is the president and CEO of NYSERDA. Doreen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The company behind a proposed hydroelectric project using the Ashokan Reservoir in the Catskills is scrapping the proposal after strong opposition. Instead, the company will start anew, looking at other reservoirs in the New York City watershed to site its energy project. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn spoke with the president of PowerTech Engineers this week, minutes after he submitted a formal letter of withdrawal.
President of California-based PowerTech Engineers Victor Rojas says he sent a letter to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission withdrawing a proposed pump storage project that faced massive opposition. The proposal from affiliate company Premium Energy Holdings sought to generate hydroelectric power by drawing from the Ashokan Reservoir and creating a new dam and reservoir. The public comment period closed at 5 p.m. Local elected officials, environmentalists, and area residents say the company did not do any outreach, a mistake Rojas says he won't make again.
Well, right now we decided to just close the Ashokan initial project the way it was presented to FERC in the application and just start all over again. First, with the consulting with the communities and doing all the legwork first with the New York City and everybody else that are the main stakeholders. And once we have something that is more acceptable to the stakeholders, then moving to an application to FERC, to a new application to FERC. The scheme that we have proposed initially impacted very badly some communities, and even though we were changing our plans after we hear their concerns, there was still a lot of nervousness around, and we decided that maybe it's better to give a little bit of peace to the community to withdraw the application, and then, like I said, start from zero again with something that is that will have the buy-in of the community first before we move forward with an application. We have formally withdrawn the application through a letter to FERC.
That you sent today?
Yeah, we sent today like maybe half an hour ago.
Rojas says he considered filing an amendment proposing new locations, but decided that with all the opposition, a complete withdrawal made the most sense.
So we say, wait a minute, maybe it's better just to withdraw this and start from fresh again and maybe have a different approach this time.
Yeah, because people were very upset here that they weren't notified, you know, from anyone from you or your company about what was happening, no public outreach. And while that may not have been a requirement based on the size of communities, they certainly took umbrage to the fact that they weren't contacted.
Yeah, we published an announcement in a local newspaper, I don't know which, but that's part of the FERC rules for the application. But sometimes it's not as effective as maybe outreaching specific communities and just letting them know that that we had this plan on mind. So next time around, we want to be just outreaching specific communities, regardless of the size, and make sure that they are all on board with this plan so that there are no surprises.
Do you have a timeline for when you might begin this outreach and propose another project?
Maybe within a month, we'll be touching doors again, and maybe outreaching the community. First, we need to talk to the owners, which is the city of New York, and then we have to touch bases with the communities, and then moving forward with the application. So anyway, we're making sure this time goes smoother than this one, this experience.
By City of New York, he refers to the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, which had submitted comments opposing the project. Rojas says the new proposal might include the Neversink and Rondout reservoirs.
And the only concern is that we like to make it a closed loop so that the turbidity, the quality of the water is not affected. So we're trying to come up with something to some solutions, some engineering solutions to present to New York City to make sure that their concerns of affecting the quality of the water has been taken care.
Hundreds of comments opposing the initial proposal poured into FERC over the past several weeks.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
Scientists in northern New York launched a complicated experiment last week, hoping to find out if salmon can be reprogrammed to consider Lake Champlain home. The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation positioned aquatic cages and then stocked them with Atlantic salmon at the Plattsburgh Boat Basin last week. As the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports, it's a complex job to try to reestablish the fish in the lake.
In the parking area of the boat basin, there are a number of openwork frames sporting mesh walls waiting to be sunk next to docks. Each 6x6x20-foot frame is hand-carried by 6 to 8 people as close to the shore as possible, where floats are then attached to the top.
What a team, what a team!
Then the real challenge begins. The pens are too large to fit through a gate leading to the docks, so they must be carried down the bank to the lake. The first choice closest to the docks is jagged and rocky.
Very slow, very slow.
After this first try, it's decided to try a second location where there are fewer rocks and it's less steep. But it's uncertain if the water is deep enough to tow the frame through the water to the docks.
Coming down. Don't let it roll that way.
The group discovers that if they carry the pen into the water upside down, they can float it to the boat, which then tows it into position at the dock. On Thursday, two trucks outfitted with tanks carrying 24,000 young salmon or smolt back up to the end of the parking lot closest to the docks and awaiting pens. DEC personnel and Trout Unlimited volunteers then begin a bucket brigade to get the smolt to their new pens. DEC Region 5 Fisheries Lake Champlain biologist Nicole Balk tells the volunteers what to do.
So we've got some 5-gallon buckets over here. We're going to bring them over. We're going to have people, we're going to unload one truck at a time. And when you get your bucket, we'll tell you 1, 2, or 3. That's your net number that you're going to go to.
The attempt to imprint these waters on the fish using the pen rearing technique is an experiment at this location. Lake Champlain Basin Program New York Citizens Advisory Committee Chair Vic Putman says this is part of the fisheries management plan to reintroduce landlocked Atlantic salmon to the lake.
They were extirpated in the early 1800s. And this is just another phase to improve the fisheries within Lake Champlain.
Trout Unlimited member Don Lee echoes the importance of reestablishing the native Atlantic salmon species to the area.
The salmon was a native fish to Lake Champlain. So we're trying to put back in the river, balance the nature, what was here. They were extirpated a long time ago, probably about 150 years ago, with the advent of dams. They built a lot of these little dams, and a lot of these little dams prevented the salmon from getting upstream to their natural habitat.
In a few weeks, the penned salmon smolt will be released into Lake Champlain. At the same time, the DEC will release an equal number of non-imprinted salmon at the same location. Nicole Balk says they are testing their hatchery and stocking methods.
We had to wait a little while, 2 years about, for the fish to grow in the lake, and then when they return, we'll catch them. Anglers will catch them, and we'll ask people to submit samples, either a fin clip or some scales, just for some genetic tissue, because these fish have been genetically, quote, marked at the hatchery. If the net pens do better, maybe we'll change our stocking practice. If the hatchery fish do better, maybe the net pens aren't the way to go. But we wanted to try something and see if it could help.
The Department of Environmental Conservation says pen rearing has been successful in Lake Ontario and Lake Erie with Chinook salmon and steelhead for more than 20 years.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2116. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.